Good morning, everybody. We don't have quorum yet, but that being said, we can, I think, start to discuss the bills before us. Representative Runbeck, would you mind coming forward to start introducing House File 782?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, and I do have a couple of handouts, if the pages would help out with that.
I think there'll be pages do have them, and they're bringing them around. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for the chance to bring House File 782. And I would urge you to take a look at the testimony that I'm passing out. My witness is a working guy and was not able to make it today. And the attorney who understands the case very well, because he litigated it, is in the courthouse with another case, of course. So, but my colleague Bob Detmer will be joining me just because he is familiar with this situation as well. But the issue in the bill is the issue of issuing debt by municipalities. And we've seen that, we know that current law says that when cities issue general obligation bonds, that the citizens have a right for a referendum. They can vote on it. They can weigh in on whether the city, whether they approve the city's issuing bonded indebtedness. And in recent years, we've had situations where there is a loophole in the current law when cities can really go around that law, and it's called a lease revenue bond. And what happens is the cities say that they're going to let their EDA build a facility, but the city will rent it from itself, essentially. And so that's the revenue stream that is created. So the lease revenue bond is currently a loophole, and we're trying to close that loophole because citizens right now have no recourse. They have no opportunity to weigh in. And the situation grew out of a Forest Lake situation where, and I'll just refer you to the second and third paragraph of the letter from the citizen who brought the case. Morning, Bob. And the situation, because the bill really sets up a process as well, so that if cities, it's not to say that the lease revenue bond method is not legal. It is legal. It's fine to do. But we're giving citizens the opportunity here to have a process by which they learn about what's happening and have a chance to develop a petition and then have a referendum if they feel that this is not a course they want to take. But in Forest Lake, on the night before the election, the Forest Lake City Council quietly brought forward and passed on a 3-2 vote a $30 million development agreement to purchase land, remove the structure, and construct a municipal campus on the site of a former mall. And there was no advance notice of the project to the public, no public relations campaign to educate the voters, and some creative restructuring and a quick real estate closing. There was no way for the project to be undone by a newly seated city council in January. So this is basically, he'll go on to get a lot more detail here. But what the bill does is set up a process. So there has to be notification, and citizens can come to a hearing about the project, and then they have 30 days by which, if they feel this is not a project they can support, they can develop, they can get the 5% number of folks to come and sign a petition that they want to have a referendum. So that's really what it does, and it really brings in line with the current law what we've allowed citizens to have the opportunity to do, which is to weigh in on these issues of bonded indebtedness. And the bill would apply to HRAs, to EDAs, and to port authorities. So we're kind of covering the basis here in terms of, the different entities that the city might say, well, maybe we'll let the EDA do this, and so on. So that's the extent of the bill, and would encourage any questions you might have. And I know my colleague here is very interested in the bill as well, so he may have some comments.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. And members, we do have quorum, and the chair calls the meeting to order. Members, let's dispatch with the minutes. Is there the chair would entertain a motion to approve them? Representative Hertaus moves approval of the April 7th, 2015 minutes. Any additions, corrections, or other discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the April 7th, 2015 minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Those minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Representative Detmer, do you have comments on the bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, you know, I sat in on many of the council, the several of the council meetings at in Forest Lake, and many times local elected officials will want the legislature to be involved. In this case, the people, the voters, asked me and also Representative Runbeck here to come forward to the legislature with this legislation to. People really want to have a say in how their taxpayer tax money is used, and in the case of this is example in Forest Lake is that they wanted a referendum. They wanted to be able to speak up and vote, and I think as elected officials we need to listen to the people that we serve, and many times when there's a special interest in certain government officials, you know, many times we don't listen. And I think this is a case where maybe this legislation will allow the voters to have a say in how their taxpayer money is used. So I support this legislation. I'm a co-author.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. With that, the chair moves House File 782 to be considered and to be laid over for possible inclusion. Members, Representative Runbeck.
If I might just make a couple of additions. So Forest Lake is not the only instance where we have seen this and where it's been contentious. Roseville is an example of another case where this was used. Cottage Grove is another case, and St. Francis as well. So, you know, this is coming into play in cities. And so there are many examples now, and I think we do owe the citizens some sort of orderly way by which they can hear about this and have a chance to react and be involved.
And we have seen this too, Representative Runbeck, in Wabasha County, the county I'm from, and one of our commissioners is going to be here to speak on my bill next, and he could probably easily testify in favor of your bill as well. Now, this again does affect both cities and counties, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I believe, and perhaps council can check on that, but I believe it's just cities.
Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chair, the definition section of this bill does say municipality means a city or a county, or a town, so on line 2.6.
Thank you. And members of Representative Detmer and Representative Runbeck, you know, as I understand it, the way the traditional approach in law for municipalities to approach these is to go through the capital improvement process, behind which already in law a reverse referendum exists, and ostensibly what we may be seeing in some cases is local units of government basically avoiding that accountability of the taxpayers, either whether intended or not, and going laterally to a different approach that doesn't have that same accountability behind it. Members, any questions or comments on Representative Runbeck's bill? Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Runbeck and Detmer, for bringing this forward. I am sorry if this was already addressed, but I'm just wondering why cities of the first class are excluded on line 2.7.
Representative Runbeck.
I think, Representative Whalen, that, and Mr. Chair, I think that it's simply too unwieldy. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of folks and many, many different, you know, public works projects, and probably very necessary public works projects. So I just think that doesn't work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Whalen. Other questions, members? With that, the chair does anyone else that would like to speak in favor or opposed to House File 782? Okay, with that, the chair lays over House File 782 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Runbeck and Detmer. Thank you.
Chair Drazkowski, would you like to move your bill?
I will, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 1671 for consideration and possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, and please start with your introduction.
Mr. Chair, so, over the last, since session began, I have been out talking to Minnesotans about property taxes. And we have, I know our committee has had two formal outstate meetings in both Albert Lea and Stewartville. And I've been to about 10 other locations. The three themes that I have heard in all of those have been three things. One, what do we do about local government runaway spending? The levies that we're seeing and the levy increases we're seeing in local units of government. What about farm property tax increases and the unbearable nature of those increases on our family farmers? And thirdly, small businesses across Minnesota and the high level of property taxation that they're seeing and brought up over and again was a statewide general levy. This bill, Mr. Chair and members, rather than going at the discussion around local government spending and levies and levy increases from an approach that brings state government to provide a top-down levy limit approach, as our state has done in the past, that basically says a local unit of government, you can't increase your levy more than X percent in the next year over what it is this year. This is a different approach to bringing some accountability or some maybe oversight, I should say, with an ability to act, as kind of Representative Runbeck talked about with the previous bill, empowering local taxpayers in the situations in which their local units of government are not being responsive to them in terms of the decisions that they make around property tax increases which arise out of spending. And so I have labeled this bill the Property Taxpayer Empowerment Act, and what it does is it provides that if in December during the, and we'll have, if we could have Ms. Dalton talk through the different parts of the bill as we go forward, but in December when the levy is certified, if that levy is more than the year before, it would open a door for taxpayers to be able to, between then and June 1st of the following year, go out and organize petition signatures to put the put a question on the following November's ballot. And that question, if they're able to get the number of petition signatures required, would be should the, and I don't have the language in front of me, and if it's probably in the bill, but essentially, should the people of this jurisdiction, of this city or county, reset the levy back to what it was 2 years prior. And so that's what the bill does. And so what it does is provides a backstop, if you will, for taxpayers. It provides the ability for the people to have a voice in situations where their governments are not being responsive to them. And it also provides the full flexibility for the local unit of government, the decision makers in the city and county, in which they are being communicative, responsive, and accountable to their taxpayers with their spending to continue to operate as they have been without any top-down state government intervention or limitations. So that's the bill, Mr. Chair, and it might help if Ms. Dalton could talk through it section by section.
Well, Chair Drazkowski, did you have a author's amendment to get it in the form, and then we could maybe have Ms. Dalton go over the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. And that amendment is the A1 amendment, and I would move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Dalton could explain the A1 amendment.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the A1 amendment, the majority of it just has to do with where the quotation marks on the question, the ballot question. And so that's what most of it is doing, and the rest of it is very minor language changes.
Strictly a technical amendment, Mr. Chair.
Chair Drazkowski, are there any questions on the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of passing the A1 amendment, signified by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Nay. It's amended. And at this point, would you prefer Ms. Dalton to go section by? Ms. Dalton, if you could, for the committee, go over the section by section.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sections 1, 4, and 5 are just various times when the local government needs to make a notice to the taxpayers, one on the truth and taxation statement, one on the final tax statement, and one on the publication in the newspaper that if a local government increases its levy, voters have the option of petitioning for a reverse referendum on the levy in the following year. So 1, 4, and 5 are just notification requirements to the taxpayers. The heart of the bill is actually in Section 3, which is provides for the reverse referendum if a county or a city increases its property tax. So if they certify a levy, say in 2016, that is higher than their levy in 2015, the voters would have until June of 2016 to say, you know what, we aren't real happy about that, so we want to be able to vote on what you do next year. And so if they do that, then there would be a referendum at the November general election. If there is no general election in November, it would be on the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November. So it would be held at the equivalent time. And the ballot would basically be, do you want to support the proposed levy for 2017? And if the answer is no, then the result is that the maximum levy that the city or county would be allowed to impose would be equal to its non-debt levy from 2015 plus whatever it needs for its current debt. Now, there is also a provision in the bill that says if a petition has been filed, the city cannot issue any new debt until after the referendum has been held. So they can't just go out and put on a lot of new debt to increase their levy. Regardless of the So the referendum will set a maximum levy amount in either case, whether the referendum passes or the referendum fails and this new maximum is set. The local government always has the option to certify a levy less than whatever the maximum amount is from the referendum.
Representative or Chair Grzechowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Dalton, thank you. That outlines the bill and the mechanics of the bill rather well. I do have a testifier with me, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Harms from Lake City.
But before that, Representative Anderson, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Ms. Dalton, just a question again on the timing of all of this. In December, Truth and Taxation Statement about the 2016 levy is the one that they would petition for to get the reverse referendum. And that election would be in the November of 2016, for example. But that money's already been spent. So this would affect the levy for 17 and not 16, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that would be correct. There's frankly just no way of holding a referendum on that first year's levy in a way that's timely that would actually work with the budget process.
Representative Drzkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, former Wabasha County Commissioner Dave Harms is here to testify for the bill.
Mr. Harms, please identify yourself and your affiliation.
Good morning. My name is Dave Harms, and I'm a resident of Lake City, Minnesota. I left the county board through the election process in this last year, so I left office after 12 years. I think this bill is a great bill to have. I live in a rural county, somewhat economically depressed, and I hear a lot of people, both within the city, which was my district, and throughout the county, saying that, what good does it do? We never get to say anything anyhow. They're going to do what they're going to do. And I think this gives, if nothing else, an avenue for people to have a voice in government again. And I think that's important that they have that voice. They're paying the bill, and they need to feel that what they say is important to the people that they elect to the offices that are held. We did go through, as Representative Runbeck stated in her bill, we went through that in Wabasha County about 10 years ago with a jail and court building. And there was a lot of angst over that at the time. I was not in office at that time. I had been out for one term and then got back in again. But that was a tough thing for the citizens to swallow, and the tax impact was tremendous. They went with the what they called geo bonds, and went through the HRA to avoid having it go to a referendum. And I think that the jail would have been built regardless. Some of the amenities and additional office space probably would not have been built, and that would have been acceptable to the people at that time. So it has definitely some benefit, in my opinion, to move this bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Harms. And the chair is aware of the gallons of newsprint utilized on that story, and I'm sure that there are other counties that have had, from time to time, similar. I would like to go on, since I'm not seeing any questions. There's another testifier on the list, Mr. Carlson. Oh, apparently Carlson is like Anderson, is a popular name in the state. Please identify yourself and your affiliation, and any other Carlsons wishing to testify, please approach. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll start first ahead of my brother, Gary. Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the greater Minnesota counties with regional centers in them and 4 counties here in the metropolitan area. We do appear in opposition to this bill. Our opposition is both on several fronts, both based on policy, based on practical issues, and based on unintended consequences. But foremost, it's really questioning the need for this bill. I have had a chart passed out that shows the levy increases by level of government for the past 5 years, and you'll see that counties have consistently been among the lowest, if not the lowest, of any of the several levels of local government. So we strongly question whether this needs to be put into effect. All those relatively small increases have been despite significant new costs that we have had to take on, in part because of new state mandates. In terms of the policy issues here, first place, Minnesota taxpayers are frankly the best informed in the nation, with the separate truth and taxation notices and the actual tax statements, both of which provide a comparison between the prior year's taxes and the coming or current year's taxes. All taxpayers are provided ample opportunity to comment on the decisions being made by the city councils and county boards because of the state's open meeting law and the required truth and taxation hearing that is imposed on all counties. Secondly, because of the 2-year time frame that Ms. Dalton just went through in the bill, by the time that 2-year period has run, we will have already gone through an election cycle where for counties at least 2/5 or 3/7, depending on if we're talking about a 5 or 7 member county board, will have been gone through election. So if taxpayers are unhappy with the decision that board has made, they can show it at the polls by voting those individuals out of office. Consequently, we think this is totally unnecessary. Practical issues are that new information will be required to be placed on the statement. The levies for the prior year and the current year for the city and the county, which will make an already crowded tax statement even more crowded. It will be confusing for many taxpayers because they won't, frankly, understand the difference between the levy which is the tax on all taxpayers in the jurisdiction, and the current tax on their specific property on the statement. And it will also create frustration for some taxpayers who will see their individual tax go up for reasons other than the levy. Those could include valuation changes, changes in the classification of the property, or expiration of special tax provisions. They'll frankly and possibly be asking, well, why can't we have a referendum? I don't care why my taxes are going up. But, you know, quite reasonably, there should not be a referendum since it's outside of any factors that's affected by the county or city. This does not fit current budgeting schedules. With our current truth and taxation laws, basically cities, counties, all jurisdictions have completed most of their budgeting decisions by the time they certify their preliminary levy on either September 15th or September 30th. With this law, if a petition is filed, they'll basically be left in limbo then for another month and a half as to whether the revenues that they've planned on will actually be available, and then they'll be scrambling for the remaining portion of November and December if such a referendum is successful to rejigger their budget to meet the new level of revenues that's available to them. Another problem is that a mere increase of 1 cent or just to meet debt service on existing bonds, which vary from year to year, because in most years the debt service levy is only to pay the interest on those bonds. There's certain periods during the duration of the bond where a series of those bonds are paid off and where the debt service levy rises to do that. That simple change, despite the fact that there's no change in the operating levy of the city or county, would trigger the possibility of a referendum. Particularly concerned with the fact that there are no exceptions for natural disasters or other emergencies, for new county mandates that are certainly significant for counties, or for non-debt contractual obligations whose costs will rise over their term. Finally, most significantly for counties, is this will cost us money regardless of wherever subject to the referendum. We will have to reprogram our computer system since we're the ones that administer the property tax system, and possibly incur new costs for the printing and mailing of these now more lengthier documents. With regards to the unintended consequences, any city or county that's facing the possibility or fears that they're facing the possibility of a referendum is likely to react by saying, well, if we're going to raise our levy X, we might as well raise it X plus Y, because then we'll have some money in the bank that when a referendum causes us to have a petition causes us to have a referendum that's successful and cuts our levy in the following year, we'll have money in the bank. So the phenomena that you potentially will see under this bill is a yo-yo phenomena of levies, of high levies in the first years. The levy goes down in the second year. There can't be any petition in that second year because the levy will be less than the following year. And so the levy can go back up the next year, and then the cycle starts over again. Not a really good way to run government. And finally, it will incent further reliance on non-levy sources of revenue, such as special assessments and fines and fees. That may be great from some perspectives, but it's not great for the taxpayer, because whereas property taxes can be deducted on individuals' income tax returns, they qualify for the state's homestead credit or property tax refund, or the state senior citizen deferral. None of these other sources of revenues do. So with that, I'll conclude. As is obvious, we do oppose this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Before we go to Carlson 2.0, your testimony indicated just how complex and convoluted and, you know, no matter what the intent of the author on a bill in this area, it's not simple. It'd be I guess, easier if the author just said you have to pass the voters before it goes in effect in the first place would take care of the yo-yo, but I have a feeling that there'd be even more people lining up if we did that. So, Carlson 2.0, you're on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Let me first say that I'm not his brother, but he did steal a lot of my testimony, so I'm going to try to shave off the things that he's already said. The League of Cities opposes this legislation as well. This would be a significant deviation from the past practice of setting local budgets. We've had reverse referenda and referenda requirements on specific types of activities, but never on the general fund budget, to my knowledge, and this would be a significant change. And the reason for our opposition, again, is that we elect city councils to make the decisions on the operations of a city, on the budgets for a city, and that's where the voters have their recourse, as Mr. Carlson, 0.10, so indicated with the counties. A couple of other comments. I think Mr. Carlson mentioned that there are carve-outs for debt levies. I did talk to one of the MIPF attorneys, the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance attorneys, last night, and they indicated they're going to share some thoughts with Representative Drazkowski about possible problems that may be created for GO pledges on some bond issues. I think Mr. Carlson indicated some of those issues. I think you'll expect to see or hear something from some of the bond council on some concerns they may have, but they did not have those comments ready today. And as Mr. Carlson indicated, disaster special levies that had been authorized under current or past levy limits would not be an authorized extension under this bill, nor would new state or federal mandates that frequently do burden city budgets and cause us to spend more on defined programs that are outside of our control. Finally, I think that one of the things that you really should think about with this bill, and I think Representative Anderson kind of hit upon this, the referendum trigger would be the previous year levy increase. The petition would be actually sought before the city or the county would actually certify their proposed levy for the next year. So without knowing what the city or county proposal was for the subsequent year, by June 30th, the taxpayers would have to petition for a referendum. And then at the general election, they would then see what the levy increase or non-increase would be. In some cases, cities do freeze their levies. And they would not know when they were petitioning what the actual proposed levy was for the subsequent year. And I think that's a timing issue that we need to think through very carefully. And finally, and I think accentuating what Mr. Carlson said, we had 45 cities last year that actually reduced their property tax levy. That's about 5% of all of our cities. I would venture to say that some of those councils will say, well, if we reduce our levy, just simply to go back to where we were in the previous year would potentially subject us to a referendum requirement, and you might see cities not making the free and open decision to actually change their budget according to what their actual needs are. They may actually be reacting to incentives created by this new law. With that, Mr. Chair, I will cut my testimony short and echo the rest of what Mr. Carlson said.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. And Mr. Carlson, I believe that there are some member questions. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the two Carlsons, you know, I think the issue here is how do we empower the people? You know, as a legislator, I hear from the people all the time about their property taxes. So what I've instructed them to do is pay attention to publications, announcements about when budget setting time occurs. But from your perspective, and so that's been my way of trying to engage the people. From your perspective, from the county association and the city association, how do we educate the people or empower them more to know what's going on in their governmental units?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson.
Erickson,
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
In all frankness, I think there's great empowerment already existing within the current law. As I said, we're unique, I believe, among all 50 states in having the truth in taxation notice with the specific tax on the property as proposed under the budget by the respective city, county, school district, so on, and the opportunity to comment on that at a hearing before that levy is adopted. There's certainly room for greater participation by the individuals earlier in the process, and as you say, that really puts the onus on the individual to follow the information that's distributed by the city, the county, the school district, and on the local newspapers to follow those hearings. But ultimately, the onus does fall on the individual. Right now, he or she has that opportunity to appear at any of the hearings and ultimately to vote the policymakers out of office if they're not happy with their decisions. I think, frankly, that provides ample opportunities since that's basically a two-year cycle. The same as would exist under this bill. But, again, it does put the onus on the individual taxpayer to engage, to have what you desire occur.
Representative Erickson?
Well, you know, the Truth in Taxation statement is too late. Because I've been at those hearings, and you know, for the most part, the county or the city, the school district, they have made up their minds. So why couldn't we have a statement on the property tax form that reminds people about the budget setting process and when it begins? Because it actually begins in July, at least it does in my area. And perhaps if we just did that, at least we'd be taking a step that's empowering, so that at least we have done due diligence in saying, remember, citizens, you engage in this process early on. Because it used to be that you could go to Truth in Taxation and you could say your piece and maybe the board would change its mind, but that doesn't occur very often. In fact, probably not at all. So it has to happen much earlier, and that's how we empower the people. And I don't know if we should have a discussion about that. I think a reverse referenda could work, but you know, I understand what you're saying too, and you know, all the unintended consequences that can occur. But there has to be a way that that we engage people in a better sense, and I think maybe just taking that initial step to put a statement on the property tax statement about when you engage for the next go around might help.
Thank you, Representative Erickson, and I can say that I am aware of a county and a city that had several dozen people show up. A few years ago, and in fact, some people who were at that meeting are present, and they'll be talking to a later bill. And they ended up after that meeting not raising either at the city or the county level. So it does happen, but you're right, it requires the citizens to know and to be there and to be active. And Representative Anderson had a question.
Not a question, Mr. Chair, a comment following up on Representative Erickson. I agree that the process in some fashion is too late in the game. A lot of these truth and taxation statements, and I come from the county side back home, are in December, early December. Not a lot of people show up because I think they feel that it's pretty much done already, and the levy has to be set by December 31st. So if nothing else, moving up that TNT meeting earlier in the process, I think may give people more of a feeling that they could impact the process and do it earlier, when the board would have a chance to react to that and possibly make some changes if the people would want that.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And if anyone from the public is wishing to, or anyone else wishing to testify, we do have one member question, but please approach Representative Yakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I'm the most recent one here that's had to set a city budget as of last December. But Representative Erickson brings up a point that we struggled with at local government constantly, was trying to get people engaged. We finally worked with the county when we put out the property tax papers that I just got in the mail this week, to put a sheet of paper in there explaining how our budget is set and what the process is. We set a preliminary budget in September. We make sure we have an open meeting. That we always have open meetings, but we have extra time booked in for people to come down and talk about it, so that they have from September to December to adjust that levy. And the 9 years I was on council, I think almost every single time we lowered it after September before we set our final one in December. So there local governments are, it's a struggle, I mean, to get people involved. There's got to be some sense of personal responsibility, too, to get people to pay attention to what we do. It always felt sometimes like we were making a decision in the vacuum because people just didn't pay attention. They didn't, or they didn't understand what local government does versus county government versus school board. It's hard for people to grasp, well, I don't use city services because I never call the cops or have to call the fire department. It's like, well, did you flush your toilet this morning? Because if you did, you use city services. So it is a struggle, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for people to get engaged if they so choose, but it's hard to get them to pay attention sometimes.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question about the mechanics of the bill, maybe for staff. Is this based on absolute dollars? So, and this, I'm probably just betraying being relatively new to this area, but is it the total number of dollars? And if the total number of dollars increases, that is what figures the referendum in this case, if you understand my question?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, it is the absolute dollars. So if the, as Mr. Carlson said, if the levy goes up even $1 in total, the option for petitioning for a referendum is out there. Now, that's the other thing that I think needs to be kept in mind is that to invoke a referendum, you need signatures by 10% of the voters from the last general election. So that's a fairly high bar to reach. You have to have 10% of your voters unhappy with the increase. I doubt that you're going to get 10% of your voters who are going to be unhappy with a $1 increase in the levy.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I guess a concern that I have on this, and I don't know if I heard the testifiers talk about this, but just, I mean, simply taking inflation into account, if the taxing authority simply wants to be able to, buy the same amount of goods and services and there's inflation taking into account, sounds like just this is not at all adjusted for inflation, as I gather. This is just absolute dollars. Okay, and I guess that's another concern that I have as well. Thanks.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to add comment to what Representative Youakim had mentioned. And for those of us sitting here, there's many of us have been on councils, and there's at least three mayors, I think, in the room, past mayors. And it seems like constituent involvement usually begins when they open that letter that shows what the property tax statement is, because that's the notice that suddenly things have changed. And if we could figure out a better way of notifying people in advance, it seems like they need that written notice almost to get people involved in the budget process. But it's just one of those imperatives to get people involved in you're closest to your government at the local level, and your voice is diminished as you go up each of the rungs of the ladder. So it begins there. Thanks.
Thank you. And once again, if the author can approach the table, once again, anyone from the audience wishing to testify? Chair Druskowski, if you could do a closing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Actually, we've got Representative Mariani, or not, Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was waiting because I had some questions for the author, and actually several questions, but the first one is, why do you exclude townships? I mean, that's almost 1 million residents. Why do you exclude them from being able to participate in this?
Mr. Chair.
Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Marquardt. I think mainly because they are the closest and most closely knit form of government. They have an annual meeting every year. And a lot can be hammered out at those annual meetings, so I think I think that's probably the main reason. It wasn't meant to single anybody out or anything. It was just a kind of a practical thing. I mean, they're the most responsive unit of government I think we have.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Marquardt,
Representative Druskowski, when I look at, I'm not going to ask you if you know what this is. I'm just going because I've got them here, but. In the last, and first of all, I do support levy limits. I have voted for levy limits many times. With due respect, I don't think this is the right way to go, but that's just a difference of opinion. But the county levy in the last 5 years have averaged 1.4% increase in the last 5 years. And we know that In cities, the average has been 2.2%. Now, our cities and counties, some going, you know, that's the average, of course. So there's many higher and many lower, but that's the average. And we know that what drives a lot of the levies is inflation plus growth. I mean, that's really what drives cities' budgets there, growth plus levy. And when I looked at what's happened in the last 5 years in the state, the average population growth is about 0.6% a year. And when I go back and look at the last 5 years of inflation, it's about 2.0%. So if you just take growth plus levy, it's about 2.6% in the last 5 years, which means both the county and the city are under that. And so there's residents, there's cities that go above that that create a real angst, but I don't know if you're getting to that. I mean, if in fact you want to prevent the ones that you think are maybe abusing levies in that, then, you know, set some sort of a levy limit. But to kind of do a blanket thing, and I think you heard that from the Mr. and Mr. Carlson as they were up here, you know, when you've got the average, that's pretty low here. And one more thing to remember is that the levy, the final levy is not just determined by your local units of government. For example, I'm going to take payable 2012. When the county increase that year for 2012 was 0.4%, only $12 million of increase statewide. City's levy increase in 2012, payable 2012, was 0.9%, which was only $17 million, which means between all the cities and all the counties in payable 12, the increase in total levy was $29 million. And yet for payable 12, the total property taxes went up $361 million, 4.8%. And the main reason was because that was the year that the market value homestead credit was eliminated, something the state did. And so when the taxpayers got those statements, now some, I mean, there's a bit of a disconnect there because, in fact, the counties and the cities kept their levies very, very low. And yet, because of something the state did, really ratcheted those up. And the final point I'm going to make, and you know, you hear always the wasteful spending, and I, you have elected officials both in the counties and the cities, and in the cities you've got a lot of mayors who are elected every 2 years, not the 4 years. So there's plenty of accountability there. If people have a concern about levies and that, they can go to their elected leaders every 4 or 2 years and vote them out. But I'm hearing a lot about this runaway spending on the city level and so forth. I heard a lot about the runaway spending on the legislative level. And yet, 2 weeks ago, in the Ways and Means Committee, the House majority approved of the highest spending level ever in the 157-year history of this great state. After all the complaints about this runaway spending, all the wasteful spending, the spending level that was set by the Ways and Means Committee by the House is an all-time high. $600 million more than the previous high. So, I mean, you hear about this and, you know, maybe instead of even looking at the cities here on runaway spending, you know, look at ourselves. Look at yourselves on what you've approved here. So I don't think it's the right way to go. If you want to look at certain cities over a certain amount, I think that's legitimate. But I don't think the data here shows that we have runaway spending on our local units of government. And, you know, townships only 2.5% increase. That's not even population growth plus inflation. And, you know, I think that's why we've had levy limits in the past, to at least allow cities and counties to do that. And I've supported that. But to come up and kind of basically kind of set zero and take away local control And then there's a lot of things the state, we do, that forces up property taxes. I just think this is not the right approach to do, and yet I would support some levy limits.
Well, thank you, Mr. Marquardt. I guess I would clarify the most local control is the voter. And so when we talk about taking away local control, when you take it back to the individual citizen, that's just about as local as you can when you hand them control. But I do understand the state implying and imposing limitations on the local governments. And thank you for, you know, every member has this graph of the data, and you brought up 2012 and the disastrous increases. Well, I'm trying to figure out, you know, why 2015 has what, five times the rate of increase for counties and over four times the rate of increase for cities. Just what was in the last budget that maybe precipitated that? And I'm hopefully everybody will realize when you commented about the biggest spending coming out of the present Ways and Means, that more money increase, et cetera, et cetera. I hope we don't ever hear the words harsh cuts, you know, horrible cuts, you know, et cetera, since it's been set straight that so much more money is being spent. But we do need to move on with the bill. And if the we've got one more question from Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Discalzi, it's actually to the bill. Quick question. Just because I'm trying to understand how this works with rental properties, can you explain a little bit how this process would work for renters that basically pay property taxes through their rent but aren't going to be getting the property tax statement? How would they have a say?
Representative Druskowski, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I maybe ask Ms. Dalton if there's anything in the bill regarding that. But they would certainly, Representative Joaquin, they would have the ability to petition as well, their citizens. And they would have the ability to vote on the reverse referendum. Their ability to participate is not limited. The question is about whether they would be notified that there was a levy increase.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there are two places where renters would be given the notice. Right now, truth in taxation statements must be hung in the apartment buildings and things like that. And since there is a notice on that, they will get that. And then Section 4 requires that the newspaper notice of tax rates also include that notification.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I saw that too in the current law. What I'm wondering is, from what I understand in your law, when they're sent out the tax statement, there's a place on the bottom where they can then check off and turn it back in on whether or not they want a petition, or is this a petition that's going to be available for anybody to sign? Because from how I'm reading it, the only people that would be able to do the check off are the ones that physically got the statement, which in Section 1 is supposed to be sent to the address listed on the county's current year's assessment roll. So it goes to the property owner. So how does that petition facilitate it?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the petition isn't a checkoff on the tax statement. So it would be handled the way any reverse referendum petition is handled for any special law, which is that the voters would basically have to go out and get, you know, signatures. And any registered voter is allowed to be a signature on the petition, whether they are a property tax owner or a renter.
Got it. I just wanted to check, because from how I was reading it, I wasn't sure. And if a owner of a property didn't live in the city, they would not be able to sign the petition then? So there's cross-check to verify whether or not they're registered voters in the jurisdiction?
Ms. Dalt.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be the regular rules that relate to petitions for referendum, and yes, basically you have to be a registered voter residing in that municipality to be on the petition and recognized as part of the 10%.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that because I was a little worried that we were going back to a landed society where only people that own property got a chance to trigger a referendum. And in Hopkins, we have 57% rentals. So that worried that we'd be leaving more than half our people off the process. But just one final comment. I know a lot of us have served on local governments, and we take our jobs really seriously when we set budgets. It's the hardest thing we do, besides maybe putting in a sidewalk. Those are pretty bad. But those of you who have gone through that process understand exactly what I'm talking about. But we are really accountable to the voters, and we set the taxes on things that matter to them every day. And every 2 years, there's an election. And that accountability shows. And when we talk about local control, it is about local control. And you either trust the local governments to do their job or you don't. So I worry a little bit that this is throwing that balance off. So thank you.
Representative Chair Trichowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Joachim and Representative Markwart and other members. Mr. Chair, you stole my thunder on local control, and I heard a couple members talking about local control, and because it's the local government does not make it local control. The most local control is the local people and the local voters and the local citizens, and that's what this bill aims to do, is to empower them to in the face of a situation where the local government was not being responsive to them, to be able to act and have an ability to bring action forward to change the direction of what is happening locally. Now, I will mention also that in a very large amount, probably the vast majority of our cities and counties, this would probably never be used. Or it wouldn't be used, certainly extensively. As we look at and we do have reverse referendums in law right now, and that whole law is what guides this whole process, and that's what Ms. Dalton was saying. So this doesn't create anything new in terms of the referendum process. So we just would abide by that like every other reverse referendum does. So this restores to people the ability to have to bring action forward, to provide a disincentive, if you will, for local units of government that are overspending. And Representative Markwart, this last year it was 4.6%, I think, was the increase, if I remember properly, between the blended three government average. And in the same period of time between 07 and 2013, the U.S. Census data that we have suggests that the median family income in Minnesota has actually decreased $4,320 per family. Now, it's interesting, members. We haven't been talking about government decreases and local government decreases and how much they've decreased. Each time, it's just assumed that it's going to be an increase. While families' ability to pay diminishes, government just continues to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And as I listen to Minnesotans, and Representative, you're right, whether it's local government, we're doing the same thing in the state government, I agree with you. But families are not seeing these automatic increases every year. And they're seeing significant decreases many times, as illustrated in my previous comment. So I would just offer that I think this is a local control bill, one that does not impose across-the-board levy limits, and I'd be interested to talk to Mr. Carlson and Mr. Carlson about which one would they prefer, one where the local government and the local people had the ability to better interface and bring an added level of accountability to them, or one where state government came out and said, stamped it out in law and said, you can't go across this line. And the way this bill is written is it provides that local government the ability to operate as it always has, and I would suggest that if a local government is being responsive to its citizens and is doing a 1% or a 2% each year, are that people going to go out and gather 10% of the signatures of the voters because of a 1% or a 2% increase? Probably not. And probably not the vast majority of times. So I think if this is enacted into law, what it will be is basically a disincentive, a reminder, a conscience, if you will, an added strengthening of the conscience of the local decision makers as they go forward through that process. It's so important in determining what those local property taxes end up being. As we know, the main driver is local government spending. So that's my testimony, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for your indulgence here this morning.
And was there one last question? Seeing none, Chair Druskowski, I'm going to renew your motion that House File 1671, as amended, be held over for possible consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, Representative Norton, welcome to the Property Tax Committee. Representative Pinto moves House File 682 be considered and laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Welcome, Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here today with House File 682. I'm going to do a little bit of background on DMC because I know we have a few members that are new and weren't here in 2013 when that passed, so I'll just give a very quick overview of that. And it's been fascinating listening to all the property tax discussion. I've never served on this committee, and so this has been a fascinating discussion. And I would say this is a property taxpayer protection bill, and so hopefully you'll give it due consideration. And the Destination Medical Center was a request of Mayo Clinic, along with the City of Rochester back in 2013, though I think its birth happened a year or two before that, or at least the germ of a concept. And it was for economic development in the City of Rochester. It was predicated on a commitment by Mayo Clinic to grow in that community, and then asking the state to help provide the infrastructure that's needed for our community to sustain the growth, not only that Mayo Clinic would do, but more importantly for other businesses. And so the promise or the goal is 25,000 to 35,000 new jobs over 20 years. And $3 billion in new revenue for the state of Minnesota during those same 20 years. It's probably worth noting, because there's tons of confusion in my own caucus, so I'm sure in the other caucus as well, that to date no money has been given by the state to the City of Rochester for the infrastructure growth, because the language as it was drafted said that $200 million of Mayo Clinic and other investors need to happen first. That needs to be verified by the Department of Economic Development, and once that $200 million is verified, then a limited amount of $30 million would be given to the City of Rochester to be used through the DMC and the EDA for this infrastructure growth. I also want to be clear that when we started with this process, the request was for $585 million from the state. And I think initially the thought was that it would be through bonding and just given to the state, or from the state to the city. That did not happen. This committee in particular, and in negotiation with the Senate, decided that the City of Rochester needed to have skin in the game, as did the county. And so this body decided that $128 million of responsibility needed of that 585 needed to come from the city, and that an additional between $30 and $40 million commitment from the county would be required as well. So that was the full package that was passed. What we didn't do in that bill was provide for funding of the DMCC, which is the board that would oversee this whole process, nor did we provide funding for the EDA, which in my mind was a private entity, and my initial thought would probably be the developers and Mayo that would fund that that particular entity, the DMC EDA, a lot of acronyms here, but that the city and county then, in particular the city, would contract with the DMC board for services, or the EDA board for services. So in reality, what we are finding, and I'll show you, so the first point I really want to be clear to you is that this body imposed $128 million plus 30 or 40 for the county on our city that they did not come here asking for, nor did they expect. They thought that the $20 million they had in a prior sales tax extension was going to be the extent of their contribution when this whole talk started. So so in 2013, we imposed this. The citizens of Rochester, there were tons of coverage, and everybody saw it, but I don't think it really sunk in. And in fact, this is a March 4th headline, and it says, sales tax hike may be needed for DMC. And I can't tell you the amount of communications, and I'm sure that the city and county heard it too. People didn't really understand what we had done to the city of Rochester. Most people are very supportive, I will tell you that. But it's been kind of a surprise. Well, what we don't want to do is make it an additional surprise. And so what this bill does is says that the city can use its current sales tax authority to pay its share of costs for the Destination Medical Center Corporation and for the EDA, and that the city count its contributions for the DMC and the EDA as part of its 128 and not in addition to the 128 we imposed on it. Because the EDA costs and the DMC costs are there, and they will continue to be there. There's some really wonderful collaboration and work being done between the city and Mayo Clinic, so that I think you will see, we will see in the city of Rochester, a scaled down version of what, how many people will work for the EDA and who will pay for those, and really some wonderful work that the city staff in particular are going to take up a bulk of some of this work. Because they already have employees that are skilled in those services rather than hiring new people to do it. So there's some really great collaboration going on. But I'm concerned, my community members are concerned, the taxpayers are concerned, that in addition to this sort of unexpected 128 and the 30 and 40 for the county, 3240 from the county, that they're going to have to raise additional taxes or take it out of the city's current budget, which no one wants to have that impacted negatively for this either. So I'm very much hoping, we haven't had really too many bumps in the road as this has moved along, but I'm happy to answer questions, and I do have my city manager and my mayor here to talk a little bit more about their support for this bill, and then we'll answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Representative Norton. Mr. Brady, Mr. Mayor, please introduce yourself. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning, Chairman Drazkowski and members of the Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee, and thank you, Representative Norton. I am Ardell Brady, Mayor of the City of Rochester, Minnesota. House File 682 does two things. It provides the city with a funding source other than property taxes to pay administrative and operating costs that we incur for the Destination Medical Center program, and it provides credit towards the city's required $128 million cost for the DMC project. It does not increase any cost to the state. To my knowledge, the Destination Medical Center is the largest economic development project ever in Minnesota. It secures the state's largest private employer, Mayo Clinic, future growth in Minnesota. It's projected to add 35,000 jobs for Minnesota in the next 20 years and to provide several billion, that's with a B, dollars in new revenues to the state's coffers through state sales tax and income tax. The Mayo Clinic, the DMCC board, the DMC EDA, the city, and Olmsted County have been working very hard every day since the legislation was passed in 2013 to make this effort a reality for the state of Minnesota. It is a critical and vitally important project for Minnesota. The city has made tremendous commitment of funding that $128 million and of time and resources to make the DMC successful. The primary beneficiary will be those families securing good jobs and the state and regional economy. We are asking for your support to assist all of the partner organizations that are working on this critical project by approving Representative Norton's bill, House File 682, for inclusion in the House tax bill. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for your time and attention. Sincerely request your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. You he doesn't want to need to testify. Okay.
We'll answer questions if you have any.
Okay, thank you, Representative Norton. Members, questions? Before we do, I've got a question. You know, and Representative Norton, I agree with you. We need to protect the property tax interests of the people of Rochester, and that's what I would term this bill as well. There's questions, and we did hear Chair Davids at a bill yesterday before this committee, too, and I know there's questions and discussions about whether or not the city is mandated to pay for these administrative costs or not. Can you talk about that?
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Well, yes, you did hear another bill, and I'm not sure it does anything, which is a little bit of my frustration here, and I do hope if you choose to move ahead with that you move ahead with this, too, because this bill does protect the city. There is no mandate, and in fact, we were quite clear in the negotiations with Mayo Clinic and others at the end of that session that the EDA was a private entity and that the city had to contract with them for services, but that it was not the city's responsibility. It was a private EDA. So as this has rolled out, it's been a little surprising to me. The city has autonomy as to how much, and they will negotiate with the EDA about how much they're going to spend. But I do think we have to remember that we did set up this DMCC structure. There are some pretty high-level folks from around the state of Minnesota in the business world who do come down to Rochester frequently. It's been very frequently to do these meetings, and we didn't provide any support level for them. And so the city is out of necessity having to pick up the tab for those. And we just want to make certain that that 128 is part, you know, when they're paying for those DMC and contracted EDA services, that is part of the 128 and not in addition, because as you can imagine, and they can tell you if you're interested in how much they've had to spend. In fact, I'm sure Gary Newman here could tell you what they've spent thus far and projected what those numbers are.
Thank you, Representative Norton. So if the city doesn't pay for the administrative costs of both, right, DMCC and EDA, right, is that if the city doesn't pay for them, who pays for them?
No one, Mr. Chair, and that's part of the, if they don't pay for them, there was no provision in law as to how they would be paid for. And I would say the DMCC board, out of the goodness of their heart, could continue to keep coming to Rochester and do that. But as I said, these are high-level businessmen and women from around the state of Minnesota that come down there and give their time. It seems like the least you could do is compensate them for their gas mileage or something. And we didn't provide for that. The EDA, on the other hand, it really was the intention of any of us negotiating that bill that since it's a private entity, that it was really up to that private entity to find its own funding source. I assumed it would be the Mayo Clinic who had come to us with the request in the first place, or some of the big developers who will be coming to develop projects in our community. So that had been my intent. I think there has been confusion about that, and so we're saying if it's going to be a joint project, that the city does have to contract with them, that is in the statute, that at least they get some protection for that contribution. And then, again, the amounts are here.
Mr. Newman, welcome.
Chairman Drazkowski, members of the committee. I think I would...
If you could introduce yourself.
I'm Gary Newman. I'm the Assistant City Administrator in Rochester.
Thank you.
I think we all have to bear in mind this is a very large project. I mean, the intent is to get $6 billion in new private investment, including Mayo Clinic investment, in Rochester. And, you know, the amount of funding, the $585 million, will be, you know, hopefully dwarfed by the private sector funding. So it's a very large undertaking, which requires a lot of work to be done. And the DMCC board, you know, has a couple of people that work for them to review contracts and plans and things of that nature. And the EDA will do a job of bringing new companies to Rochester, expand bioscience development. One of the main focuses of the plan is an area called Discovery Square, where some current vacant Mayo Clinic property will be developed into buildings that will bring in companies, we hope, from all over the country. So it's a very large undertaking, and there are costs for the DMCC board, and there's costs for the DMC EDA, some of which won't count as specific project costs. So what this language does is it broadens that to cover those costs that aren't covered. But, you know, the overall goal of this is to bring in several billion dollars in new revenue to the state coffers, and the state is the biggest beneficiary of this project, and also the people that get the jobs. I mean, you know, people having good jobs is a wonderful thing. So I think if we keep the big big picture objectives in mind, this bill will help us get there. It will help the DMCC board get there. It will help the DMC EDA to get there. And we really would request your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Representative Norton.
Thank you. There was one point I probably should have made early. I referred to it or I alluded to it, but I didn't. Wasn't clear on it. Prior to my knowledge about something called Destination Medical Center, the city passed a sales tax extension, and there was a component of that, a small component for about $20 million, a little bit more that some of you are aware of, that went to the city surrounding Rochester, but a little request for something that was targeted for DMC, and there was a lot of consternation in the community. What is DMC? And well, it's going to help support Mayo, and the referendum passed, and that money was there. So that $20 million really is part of what's been able to be used to support, up to a certain point, activities, including I think some of these other expenses that you've heard about, moving ahead. And again, we need to include anything moving ahead as part of this 128, and that does include the continued support for the DMC and the EDA, even though we had that initial $20 million.
Thank you, members. Questions? Okay. Representative Norton, final comments, or are we good to go?
We're good to go. Please support protection for my community and hopefully support for what will be a really wonderful economic boom for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. And I did include this actually in a bill that I'll be bringing before the committee tomorrow, that because it does protect the taxpayers of Rochester. I appreciate that and what it will do. With that, the chair lays House File 682 over. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Representative Quam, Vice Chair Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you could move your bill and we can get zooming here.
I would move House File 2034 before the committee for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
And basically, this is something I've thought about for years. The LGA was originally set up to help communities that didn't have the tax base in order to give the infrastructure needed by their citizens. The formula has been tweaked over the years. It's sort of convoluted. I think it needs some dramatic fixing, because many cities that have great tax bases to be able to support the infrastructure and services for their citizens are receiving fairly large per capita contributions. Fighting the battle to do major work on the formula is not a real practical thing. So I thought the easiest way to approach it would be saying a way of finding, if you've got a good tax base, then maybe we put a limit that where you still get LGA, but you'd be capped at what the average was. And that would be the simplest point to start a way of looking at fixing this. And so this bill started out with a simple sentence of, cities of first class shall not receive more per capita than what the average per capita for cities not of the first class. Because each of our first class cities do have robust tax bases and should be able to provide services to their citizens. I know this opens up a wonderful can of discussion, and I'm going to, when the testifiers come down, move off to the side so I'm sitting uphill and avoid some of the stuff that rolls down. But referring back to the bill we just heard, DMC, that's the third largest city. I'm not sure there is a smaller city of the first class that's around 28% smaller and receives over four times the per capita And the delta between what Rochester receives in LGA and what this quite a bit smaller city receives in real actual dollars is over $440 million over the, you know, two-decade period. That's about the size of DMC. And, you know, some people may say that's a large delta for another city that's first class. And, frankly, all that's debatable. But the thought that cities of first class could be held to what the average of everyone else, not of the first class, I thought was a reasonable, fair approach to start the discussion. And with that, unless there are questions specifically for me, I'll let the Carlsons and the other people signed up to testify speak before the committee.
Thank you, Representative Quam. And you did move the bill, so we're good there. Yes, we'll start off with the people furthest away, because we might not finish here this morning and may have to lay the bill over and come back tomorrow to finish it. Mr. Fanning, are you here from Duluth? We don't want you to have to come tomorrow, too.
Good morning, Chair.
Good morning. Thank members. You for coming.
My name is Daniel Fanning. I oversee community and government relations for the City of Duluth, and on behalf of the City and Mayor Ness, thank you for this opportunity. As you can imagine, I sit here before you in opposition to this bill. This would cut LGA to the City of Duluth by 77%. As you can imagine, that would be more than devastating for the City of Duluth. We have worked closely with other cities, including first-class cities and a number of other cities, represented with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, to work on the formula that's been put forth in the last several years. And in our opinion, and in our personal experience as the City of Duluth, it has worked really well. Much like St. Paul and Minneapolis in 2014, we were able to keep a flat levy. In 2015, we had a very minimal increase only to keep up with inflation. So for us, the formula has worked very well. And we continue to see economic development, which has been a long time in the making, as many of you know. Duluth, like a lot of cities, suffered from some financial distress in the 80s and the 90s and going into the early 2000s through the recession, and is finally starting to see some of that economic growth that I know many of you have heard about in Twin Cities magazines and publications, and we're just starting to really see that benefit right now. And as you all know, it's going to take some time to recover, and it's going to take a long time. So yes, the representative is right that our tax base is growing, and we're proud of that. That said, we're still paying off debt from the 80s and the 90s, particularly on street repair. Duluth is a 26-mile-wide city that is built uphill and is in a cold climate, so as you can imagine, our streets are in major need of repair, and we are grateful for the LGA we received, and quite frankly, we have consistently asked for more, but given the fact that we serve as a regional center, and we, of course, are the county seat to the largest county in the state. So we believe we've used LGA very effectively and very well, and we stand in solidarity with St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Rochester, knowing that we've put LGA to good use, and the formula has worked well for us. So on behalf of the city, thank you for your consideration. And again, I'd urge you to oppose this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fanning. Members, questions for Mr. Fanning? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fanning, thank you for coming down today. The bill as proposed would not only cut your LGA going forward, but would cut your LGA for this year. You set your levy last December, I presume. Can you just speak to what Duluth's process would be for adjusting its 2015 spending were House File 2034 to go into law?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a great question, and simply put, I mean, LGA is currently 37% of our budget. It is a $77 million budget, mind you, which is a budget that Mayor Ness, who's in his last term, or the last year of his term right now, has actually reduced. Mayor Ness has actually reduced the size of our city's budget right now. We are at $77 million, with LGA taking about 37% of that. So to answer your question, well, I can't tell you the specifics. As you can imagine, that would be that would result in devastating cuts to the city services, and of course a major levy increase that would be passed on to the taxpayers, which I'm sure none of us want to see.
Thank you.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fanning. Other questions
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney. Understanding that, I am fully, I have no problem with not introducing the hardship of, you know, implementing it this year. And so that I'm fully open to. It'd be a forward thinking approach on that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, is there an amendment in our packets for that? I didn't see one.
There, I don't believe there is, Representative Dabney, and if the author is looking to make some changes, we can make changes going forward should it be adopted as part of the committee report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, other questions for Mr. Fanning before he heads north again? Thank you, Mr. Fanning, for coming today. Okay, Mr. Lieutenant Delmonico, are you here?
I'm not from too far away.
Okay. You're not a regular here, so we like to have the regulars go last.
Okay.
We like fresh faces. Thank you for coming, Mr. Delmonico. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is John Delmonico. I'm a lieutenant with the Minneapolis Police Department and currently serve as the president of the Minneapolis Police Federation, and I represent approximately 850 sworn city and park police officers. And I'm here today to speak against this bill. A little bit of history in my experience with LGA cuts. In 2003 to 2005, when there was the last time there was LGA cuts, we cut our police department by 154 sworn officers, and I believe we cut over 50 firefighters. And I believe that was very detrimental to the city. And I also believe that Minneapolis is LGA money is an investment to the city. We have 400,000 residents that live there. We have probably another 200,000 to 300,000 people that come in there on a daily basis. So I look at LGA as an investment in the city. When the city is good, the state is good. When the city is not so good, the state is not so good. So I would hate to see these cuts come through because I truly think it would affect public safety in the city of Minneapolis, which in turn could affect public safety in the state, and would urge you to vote against it.
Thank you, Mr. Delmonico. Questions for Lieutenant Delmonico? Thank you for joining us, Shane. Thank you for your testimony, sir. Next, Ms. Bergman, are you here? Welcome. Welcome to the Property Tax Committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sasha Bergman. I'm with the City of Minneapolis, and I appreciate having the opportunity to testify in opposition to House File 2034 this morning. House File 2034 would modify the LGA distribution in current law by making dramatic reductions to three of the four first-class cities, including Minneapolis. We support the current LGA formula and have worked with other city stakeholders on the 2013 reforms that were made, which helped to improve the way the formula worked for the entire state. In the City of Minneapolis's 2015 budget, LGA comprises about 17% of the general fund and is a critical resource for ongoing operations such as police, fire, and public works. As mentioned, our population has been increasing and has now surpassed the 400,000 mark. As a city, one of our top priorities is making sure that Minneapolis is a safe place for all to live, work, and visit. And with the growing population, we strive to provide top-notch services to residents and visitors. Like other cities across the state, we have aging infrastructure, and we've been trying to keep up with maintaining those public investments over time. Since the early 2000s, as mentioned, cities have undergone significant cuts to local government aid, resulting in difficult choices for locally elected officials to make. In Minneapolis, the largest cut from one year to the next was approximately $19.7 million in 2003 LGA. The reduction to our 2016 LGA under House File 2034 is $39.3 million, which is nearly double the $19.7 million reduction that we received in 2003. We estimate that this bill would also cut our LGA, as mentioned, in the current budget year, although that may be in flux as it sounds, but that would actually amount to a cut of more than half of our current LGA in the current year, which would require addressing the $40 million shortfall in the remaining months of 2015. If enacted, this bill would have severe impacts on thousands of Minnesotans that visit and work in the city of Minneapolis and to the hundreds of thousands of residents that call Minneapolis home. And based on past experience with significant cuts, we know that the impact would be devastating, and we urge the committee to oppose House File 2034. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions. And we also have someone from our finance department here who's happy to answer questions as well.
Thank you, Ms. Bergman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Ms. Bergman? Thank you for sharing your time and thoughts with us today on the bill. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the testifier answered one of my questions I was wondering, but I was wondering if the gentleman from Duluth might have information on what percent of their general fund budget LGA provides to them.
Mr. Fanning, are you still here?
He said 37%.
37?
Yeah, 37%.
Mr. Fanning.
Mr. Chair, Representative, currently LGA represents 37% of our budget.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fanning.
Thank you.
Next, Mr. Adams, are you here? Welcome, Mr. Adams. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tim Adams, representing Ask Me Council 5 this morning, and obviously we here are also opposing House File 2034. You're going to hear a lot of information. You've already heard a lot of information, but I'm not going to cover that same information. I do want to just bring up one particular thing with you though. And this bill would effectively cap local government aid of cities at the first class at $97 per capita. If the same cap was applied to other cities, 639 of the 853 Minnesota cities would lose aid. If we look at just the committee today, the Property Tax Division, if we exclude the three members who represent a city of the first class, 10 of the remaining 14 members have cities that would lose aid if subjected to this cap. For example, Chairman Drazkowski has 17 cities that would lose aid, and Representative Quam has 4 cities that would lose aid. Legislators should not impose LGA restrictions on first-class cities that would be unwilling to impose on their own cities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Questions for Mr. Adams, members. Thank you for sharing your thoughts with us on the bill, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and I'm here to respectfully oppose this bill as well. And let me say that we would oppose a LGA change that would affect any class of city or any cluster of cities because our board of directors in 2013 did adopt a position supporting the 2013 law changes as an agreement among the city groups as a mechanism with which to distribute the LGA appropriation. That 2013 law change was really basically a decennial change that we've worked on about every 10 years to update the formula to reflect new formula factors, changing demographic and fiscal information for cities. And we started this in 1992, and we did it in 2002 and again in 2013. But our board did support that formula and continues to support the formula. Let me say that just a couple of points. I think several things have been already mentioned. 630 cities would also be capped by the $96 cap that would apply to the first class cities. That's based on the 2016 estimates by Pat Dalton. But I think you should also know that just for the four first class cities, they are actually about $48 million below the LGA distribution they received when the LGA appropriation was at its high water mark at the 2002 level that Representative Anderson's bill is trying to get us back to. The Representative Anderson's bill would increase the appropriation by $45 million. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and Rochester are $48 million below where they were in 2002. So in other words, those four cities have actually absorbed all of the overall LGA loss. That doesn't mean that other cities haven't lost LGA, but they comprise the lion's share of the appropriation reduction that has occurred since 2002 through all the budget cuts that we've had. One other way to look at the QAM bill, House File 2034, is to say, how much tax base would Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and Rochester have to get them down to the QAM level of LGA? And if you looked at the formula and tried to solve for that equation, Minneapolis's tax base would have to be 51% higher than it actually is right now. Duluth's tax base would have to be 99%, double what it is right now, to bring its LGA distribution down to that level. And the St. Paul tax base would have to be roughly 83% higher. I mentioned that because tax base is an important part of the LGA formula. The more tax base you have, the less LGA you get. And to get to that, those levels under the House File 2034, we would have to see those cities have significantly higher tax base. One last comment. One thing that you should know, and unfortunately the most recent information we have on this is 2010, but that's the last time the tax-exempt abstract of assessment was produced. And on average, cities in Minnesota have about 15% of their market value exempted from tax. That would be government buildings, churches, schools, other tax-exempt property. So on average, cities have about 15% of their tax base exempted. The city of Minneapolis has 24% of its tax base exempted from taxation. St. Paul, 29%. Duluth, 23%. Rochester, 17%. So all of those first-class cities have a higher preponderance of value that is not subject or available for taxation. Yet those properties do require services, and that does contribute to the demand for property taxes and state aid. Mr. Chair, I think that covers my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I understand, by the way, that Lake County's got about 90% exempted from their the government land ownership up there.
Mr. Chair, I think most of that is in township or an organized territory, but that's probably correct, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Questions for Mr. Carlson? Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Carlson, you mentioned that, you know, as your tax capacity goes up, your LGA goes down. And since you represent the League of Minnesota Cities, there are so many communities that you represent that are second and third suburban ring cities that their tax capacities are dwarfed by the first-class cities. And yet these smaller cities, which have relatively low tax capacities, get zero LGA. And I haven't seen much advocacy with regard to your organization in changing the formula, because all of these people are taxpayers and are sharing in the redistribution of wealth, and yet not a single dollar comes back to 8 of the 11 communities that I represent. And I'm very frustrated by that. I'm not a proponent of LGA, but the fact that it exists, I believe the formula should be distributed more equitably. So I would be curious to hear your response to representing those cities, not just in my district, but all around this, the second and third suburban rings, that get no money.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, you make a very good point. And when I first started looking at LGA about 30 years ago, there were only four cities, I believe, at the time that did not receive any LGA. And those cities were largely the power plant cities, the Beckers, the Monticellos, the Cohassets of the world. Their tax bases were so strong on a per capita basis that they received no LGA. I think what's happened over the years is we've actually seen, on a per capita basis, the amount of tax base has been concentrated, and I don't mean that in a negative sense, but the tax base growth in some communities has grown much faster than in other communities, and that has led to a greater disparity in the available tax base per capita in any individual community. You are correct that your cities have obviously far less overall absolute tax base than Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, or Bloomington, or any other of those large cities. On a per capita basis, that's another measure that is really what's part of the LGA formula. If you have a lot of wealth per person within the community, that is going to dictate under the formula that, all else being equal, the city will get less LGA under the system. In a perfect world, I wish we didn't have any city off the formula. We tried and looked at that 2013 law change to try to minimize the cities that were off the formula. Frankly, the tax base factor that goes into the formula was very, very pronounced, and it did drive many cities off of the formula. But we will continue to look at that.
Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you for that reply. And, you know, part of that wealth is paper wealth, if you will, not on the community's capacity or ability in terms of household income to really pay the taxes that they allegedly have. When you have these second and third suburban rings, which are the developing fringe, speculatively drives the land values, whether it's agricultural land, farmland's only worth what it can produce. And yet, farmland, if it's not in a ag preserve program or other thing, is being assessed at $20,000-$25,000 an acre, and carries a burden of $150 an acre of property tax just for raw land, which exceeds the profit that any row crop could ever produce. And so, you know, the folks out there are faced with a dilemma that, you know, they've got expensive land under another level of government called the Met Council that restricts growth and restricts development and requires that there be 5 or 10 acres of land under each house that disproportionately drives values up. But that doesn't mean that those people are any more capable of paying the property taxes and the so-called wealth per capita. It's a flawed system. Nobody seems to be willing to address it, and it needs to be changed. It's unfair. It's inherently unfair. And when the Minnesota Miracle was first instituted, I think the history shows that it was more equitably distributed based on the justification for having a sales tax in this state, and that we're going to share the wealth and send money to the cities, that it was distributed on a per capita basis more largely than the number of old houses or the number of how old the streets are, anything like that. Because in the development community, once things wear out, you get a new street, and part of that gets assessed to the benefiting property owners. That inures to the benefit of the value of that homestead or that property. That increases the value of the home, and it can be resold because it's got a new street and it's worth more. So, you know, I just think we fail to really address a growing problem of Representative Leshensky would be here. You know, we've got the same situation in Bloomington. Oh,
she's here now.
Thank you for showing up.
She's in hiding. She's just been very quiet.
Okay. But you know, we have this developing edge of town that are net contributors to everything. I mean, they're losers for fiscal disparities. They're losers with LGA. You know, it goes on and on. And I just wish we could get something fixed. Thanks,
Chair. Representative Hertaus.
If I could just have one quick
response. Mr. Carlson, quickly. 30 seconds.
Representative Hertaus, I mean, the LGA system is one part of the overall property tax relief system that we have in place. We obviously also have a circuit breaker or renters refund programs that are based directly on the ability to pay, and we have supported the extensions and expansions of those programs as well. And that gets at the paper wealth issue that you've raised. So all of these pieces are a part of the overall property tax system in Minnesota, and I understand the LGA system is a frustration for you, and I'll continue to talk with you more about how to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Thank you, members. Tomorrow's schedule will be House Files 2016, 1649, 1707, 1459, and 2077. I believe they should be already posted, but we will try to get those done in the morning. We're going to meet tomorrow morning again at 8:15 to 10. If we don't finish by 10, we'll come back at 12:45. Yeah, we will finish this bill up. The chair will lay this bill over until we come back tomorrow. And with that,
Mr. Chair,
announcements, Representative Dabney.
Actually, questions.
Yes,
Representative Dabney. Two. One, to clarify, we will continue this bill. Testimony on this bill tomorrow?
Correct.
Okay, and secondly, when can we expect to see the division report?
It's coming soon.
You know, Mr. Chair, the trailers are often the best part of the movie, and I do have a suspicion that will be the case here.
I'm not a movie watcher, but I watch Fox News, Representative Dabney.
I'm not at all surprised, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. With that, members, the meeting is adjourned till tomorrow.